Chapter 8. What keeps you stuck in old ruts? Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. Marianne Williamson, A Return to Love. Do you ever wonder what you might have been like had you grown up differently? If your parents had given you support for your feelings, respect for your side of the story, and considered you an important member of the family? Or if they had held you truly responsible for your behavior, instead of letting you off the hook by either rescuing or punishing you? Do you need others to tell you that you're okay? Do you feel confident in your abilities and able to do what is in your heart, regardless of whether someone else thinks it's worthwhile? Do you wish you were on a different path, meeting your full potential, doing what you are meant to do? Many of us stumble through our lives clinging to the beliefs our child selves bought into. We choose our careers, our partners, and who we want our children to be based on who our child self thinks we are, only to find out, if we ever do, that we're trying to fill a void left from long ago. Unless we decide these beliefs don't work for us anymore, search ourselves honestly, and take responsibility for making changes, we stay stuck in our old patterns and ruts. But you might say, "I turned out okay. What's so wrong?" Few of us are left without at least one or two voids that want filling. But we've adapted. We've established our role. Many of us also have chosen an addiction or habit in an attempt to fill that void, at least temporarily. Parenting the old way, even if you think it was okay for you, may not be okay for your child. But we continue to do it because it's so hard to do it differently. Old habits die hard, making different choices. Human nature resists change, even when we desperately wish for different results in our lives. Now you understand that in order to change the way you react, you need to change your assumptions, reevaluate your agenda and the standards and beliefs that control your thinking. To change their effects on you, you need to understand that they are choices you are making. If I believed as a young child that I was not good enough to get my father's approval, I have most likely hung on to some form of that belief. I don't quite measure up to other people's standards or even to my own. I'm not smart enough for that kind of career. I'm not good enough to be what I've always dreamed of. I still don't deserve approval. As an adult, I now have the power to acknowledge these beliefs and make a different choice. We can't change our childhoods, but we can decide we're not who we thought we were then. Why do we choose to keep the beliefs we had as little children? Mostly because we're used to them. It's habit. It's who we are. It's who we know ourselves to be. We can make up all kinds of excuses to keep from changing the patterns in our lives and what we believe about ourselves. For instance, we think that what we believe about ourselves is true. We'd be lying to ourselves if we thought differently. There are no guarantees that making a change in our behavior will get us the result we want. We could change and make everything worse. We're pendulum thinkers. The only alternative we see is the opposite. We don't know what else to do. The problem with the "I've tried everything and nothing works" excuse is that we have drawn only on what we already know. We don't have time. We want a quick fix. We want it now. We're too stressed. We're suspicious of newfangled ideas. The old way has worked for generations, so why change what must be right? We don't want to accept responsibility. What's wrong with me is someone else's fault, not mine. We don't trust ourselves. Relatives and friends are a restraining influence as they judge us and direct our parenting either in reality or in our imagination. "I can't stand it anymore," Bill complained in class. "Willa's behavior is totally unacceptable. No one in their right mind would let her get away with what she's doing. Her behavior has got to change, and I have tried everything." Bill is a single father raising three girls. Willa, 13, is the oldest. She thinks she's 16 and knows everything. I ground her, she sneaks out. I give her permission to go to her friends and find out she's lied and gone to a party instead. She's horrible to her sisters, and rude is an understatement to describe her behavior with me. Many parents have lived with battles for so long that specific button-pushing behavior is hard to distinguish. It all rolls into one big cumulative problem. When I asked Bill what she was like as a young child, he said, "She's always been a walking landmine. You never know what she's going to do. She's an angel one minute and then hits her sister for no reason at all the next. We never really knew what to do with her, and since it's been just me, she's pretty much gotten her way. Now she's out of control and thinks she can do whatever she wants. I'm afraid she's going to either end up pregnant or in jail." I suggested to Bill that now was the time for him to do some real soul-searching and have some father-daughter heart-to-hearts. "How do I do that when she doesn't even speak civilly to me?" Bill asked. "Do you have a story about an incident in your teens when you got in big trouble with your parents and how unfair you thought their punishment was?" "Sure," Bill laughed. "But I'm not sure telling her what I did is such a good idea. That's what I'm afraid she's going to do." "Exactly," I said. "You're afraid that telling her about it will give her permission to do it herself. Your fear keeps you from connecting with her. I imagine that you also believe it's your job to keep her from getting into trouble." He nodded. "So you must insist on obedience to do your job." He nodded again. "The problem is your standard is interfering with communicating with Willa in the only way you can right now. And if you can't communicate with her, you will have no influence on her. It's too late to lay down more rules and expect her to follow them, but it's not too late to establish a relationship with her. Are you willing to expose some of your old self to prove that you understand her?" "I don't think so," Bill said, looking at me like I had two heads. "I'm not her buddy. I'm her father, and she has to respect me." "I absolutely agree with you. How do you imagine gaining her respect?" "Well, I assumed you'd give me some strategies for better punishments. She's got to learn that she can't act this way. If she knows I mean business, she'll respect me." "Respect you or obey you?" I asked. "What's the difference?" Bill said. "There's a big difference. Did you obey your parents?" I asked. Bill said that his father used the belt to keep his kids in line. "We knew who the boss was, and I learned what I could and couldn't do. She's lucky I don't hit her. Sometimes I think that's what I should do." "With obedience comes fear, and a relationship based on fear isn't a great one," I added. "We may think it's important to sacrifice the relationship for our child's own good, but ultimately, without relationship, we cannot influence our children with our values." Bill confessed that he has little respect for and no communication with his father. We also found out that Bill hates his job but stays for the security, has never felt satisfied with his life, and has been through two tough divorces. I told Bill that if he genuinely shared some of himself with Willa, she would listen in rapt attention. He could express his fears that she will choose a life with little opportunity, and could apologize for reacting to his fear with punishments that feel unfair. I suggested ways to problem-solve with Willa that would honor the needs of both of them. I pointed out that his parenting had shifted dramatically from permissive to autocratic, and that the inconsistent expectations for Willa's behavior did not motivate her cooperation. It would take time and patience, but I imagined the relationship was worth it. Bill thought that what I suggested would mean lowering his standards and stepping out of the role he thought he must play. He was sure it wouldn't work, and that Willa would take the ball and run with it. He did not understand how this would get her to cooperate, and he was not able to see that his discipline efforts contributed to Willa's bad behavior. He knew he had been too soft, and now he had to crack down. As is true with many parents, Bill was not ready to accept responsibility or dig down to see the beliefs that drove him to unintentionally push his daughter away. How our beliefs serve us. The most critical reason for not changing our behavior is that the old way has served us for a very long time. It's like a comfortable old shoe. We actually get something out of hanging on to our old beliefs. You may say, but what could I possibly get out of something that's not working? It's the familiarity, the comfort that comes from sameness and routine. When we were little, we acted in a way that we hoped would get us what we needed, acceptance and approval, whether it was by being good or bad. Being smart little children, we adapted ourselves according to what we thought our parents wanted us to be, unless we couldn't. We created a false self and either stuffed away or exaggerated the self we thought was unacceptable. If your father convinced you that you were unimportant, it was much safer for you to go along with him than fight him. So you believed you were unimportant. You didn't assert yourself or strive for anything he thought you would fail at anyway. It probably got you a relationship, negative though it was, with your father. Or you might have seen what happened to your sister when she stood up to him and decided you wanted none of that. Believing him and adapting as best you could was the smart thing to do. Or you rebelled. You reacted strongly to the expectations you couldn't meet by becoming the black sheep or the scapegoat of the family. That, too, provided you with a role that you were forced into by family expectations. Your strong-willed temperament might have made it impossible for you to meet your father's expectations, and so his demands pushed you away. But you have led an unsatisfying life trying to prove to your father that you are somebody. Your underlying belief in your unworthiness has won out, and you have never quite made a success of your attempts. Either way, you were not heard, and your needs were not met. You had to give up some of yourself to enable this false self to develop, which continues to nag with feelings of emptiness, dissatisfaction, or hurt. You may have lived 30 or 40 years with this false self and learned how to accommodate and function. Perhaps medication has helped. It's not easy to decide to just change, to decide that you are important. That decision entails quite a bit, possibly doing something meaningful with your life. Continuing patterns of behavior confirms over and over who we believe ourselves to be, even if that belief is negative and causes reactions we hate. It's much easier to continue believing I'm a failure or I'm ugly than to believe the opposite, because all our behaviors in life have been confirming those beliefs. Andrea got her buttons pushed each time one of her daughters said, "I can't." This phrase signaled to Andrea that her girls saw themselves as inadequate and incapable. This was in direct conflict with her standard, "No girl of mine will ever think she can't do anything she wants." Andrea's parents had dampened her dreams by telling her that because she was a girl, or because she didn't have what it takes, she couldn't follow those dreams. Through the classwork, Andrea realized that she lived with the belief, "I'm not smart enough because I'm a girl." She was determined that her girls would never feel that way. So her button went off, even when she heard an innocent, "I can't tie my shoe." In class, Andrea made the connections and realized the source of her button. She believed that she was not smart enough to do anything really well, and had changed jobs often, never able to settle on a career. I asked Andrea what she got out of believing that she wasn't smart enough. She was confused. "I don't get anything out of it," she exclaimed. "I just told you it keeps me from staying with a job and doing it well." "Yes, I understand," I said, "but what do you gain by hanging on to that belief? How does it serve you to keep believing it? What do you get to avoid?" "Oh, I get it," she said slowly, thinking hard about the questions. "What do I get? I guess what you're after is that I get to keep believing I'm not smart enough." "And why is it important for you to keep believing that?" Tears came as she worked it through and understood. "If I believed I was smart enough, then I would have to show that somehow. I would have to choose something for my life and stick with it. And what if I failed? Then I would prove I'm not smart enough and my parents would win." "Is that your payoff?" I asked. "By keeping the belief alive that you're not smart enough, you protect yourself from failing to spite your parents." "Yeah," she said softly, choking back tears. "I guess I'm the only one keeping me from doing what I want. So if I give up this belief, it leaves me in the dangerous position of having to accept that I am smart and capable. Ugh, I might have to find a career and do something with my life. Wow, that would be scary." In order to model self-confidence and capability for her daughters, it was up to Andrea to change what she believed about herself. Her girls pointed the way each time they said, "I can't," because it pushed her button. When she didn't react to their words, she was able to hear their needs. She soon saw that an "I can't" was no more than a harmless way of getting her attention or help. Usually it was as simple as "I can't zip up my coat" from her 3-year-old, or "I can't do this math" from her 10-year-old. Andrea arrived the next week bursting with a success story. At 9 p.m., Sophie, 10, had plopped on Andrea's bed and said, "You have to help me with this math. I can't do it." Instead of impatiently criticizing Sophie by telling her she could too do it if she didn't procrastinate until the last minute, Andrea admitted, "I really don't know how to help you with that math." With a pathetic look that normally sent Andrea over the edge, Sophie whined, "I hate this. I can't do math." Andrea was aware of her rising feeling of hopelessness and quickly used self-talk to bring her emotions back down. She breathed deeply and said, "You're really having a hard time with that math." Sophie said, "I hate long division." Andrea said, "I know, I hate it too. Long division's hard." "So what's the answer to this one?" "I don't know." Sophie said, "Do you divide this one into this?" Andrea said, "Yes." "The teacher said we can use calculators. I'm going to go get it." The homework was soon finished, and they both went to sleep that night feeling quite competent. Andrea beamed. "I did a great job," she said. "I realized that Sophie's frustration did not mean the same devastating thing it meant to me. It was, in fact, just Sophie's frustration. It wasn't about me." Fear is the bottom line. All of the excuses we use to ward off change come from fear. Fear is an all-important emotion. It often protects us from harm, but when it gets in the way of self-change, it keeps us from connecting with our heart. It can also keep us from connecting with our children. We need to acknowledge our fear and put it aside, not deny it, not disown it, just put it aside. We need to have the courage to break out of old patterns of beliefs. We need to parent today, not in reaction to yesterday. Resisting change, maintaining the familiar, is part of the human condition. We like stability. It feels safe. But change is also a part of the human condition. The key is to take it one step at a time. Contrary to what you may think, you may not have to become a different person. What have you got to lose? Yelling, screaming, rageful accusations and blame? Power struggles and discipline methods that don't work? When you look at it that way, isn't it absurd to keep doing the same old thing?